Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in British Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jess Clark, and I'm one of the channel co-hosts. Today, I'm excited to speak with Dr. Sally Holloway, the Vice Chancellor's Research Fellow in History and History of Art at Oxford Brookes University. Her new book, The Game of Love in Georgian England, Courtship, Emotions, and Material Culture, was published in 2019 by Oxford University Press, as part of the Emotions in History series. In her book, Holloway uses innovative methods to explore the history of romantic love in the long 18th century. Examining 60 courtships from across England, she argues that romantic love was an essential part of the 18th century life cycle. In doing so, Holloway foregrounds the language of love, love letters, material objects like gifts and love tokens, and breach of promise cases, to offer new insights into this important stage in Georgian women's and men's lives. As she reveals, experiences of love, courtship, betrothal, and romantic breakdown were central elements of the 18th century emotional landscape across a range of classes and locations. Sally, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we begin by you telling us a bit about yourself? How did you come to write The Game of Love in Georgian England, and what led you to focus on romantic love in the 18th century?
I grew up in Bedfordshire. I spent a lot of time with my family visiting historic houses. I spent a hell of a lot of time going in and out of National Trust houses. From that, I always wanted to be a historian. Then I went to the University of Sheffield to study for an undergraduate degree in history. And that's when I first became interested in 18th century history, when I was studying with Karen Harvey. Then it was from there I moved down to London to do an MA in modern history at King's College London, and eventually a PhD in history at Royal Holloway. So it was while I was doing my MA that I first really became interested in the history of love and love letters. So I took a module with Amanda Vickery on 18th century women. And for one of our assignments, she sent us out into the archives, and we had to go to the archive and pick any source on 18th century social and cultural history and then write an essay on it, kind of situating it historically and historiographically. So I went to the Bedfordshire Archives, which is my local archive, and I found this amazing collection of love letters that were written partly in French, partly in code, on this gilded paper. So I cracked the code. Then that kind of later became my first article on the language of illicit love. From there, I then moved to do a PhD with Amanda Vickery at Royal Holloway on kind of love in words and objects in the 18th century. That was around the time that you had the enormous proliferation of emotions history as a field. So the Centre for the History of the Emotions at Queen Mary University of London was founded in 2008, and I started my PhD in 2009. So it was kind of a big kind of growth moment in the field. I very quickly realised that by using the history of emotions, this could provide a really exciting new lens for me through which to study kind of the history of love, the history of marriage, and the history of courtship, and kind of enable me to ask new questions. So, I mean, a lot of previous work on the history of marriage asked things like, you know, why did people get married? What were people's motivations for matrimony? You know, was it for love? Was it for status? Was it for individual choice? Was it the interests of kin? But then by using emotions history, I realized I could kind of look at the subject through this new lens. And so instead thinking about how did couples conceptualize and convey their emotions in words and objects. And so that was the subject of my thesis, and later the subject of the Game of Love in Georgian England.
Excellent. Well, why don't we turn to the book now, in which you've mobilized a broad interdisciplinary approach to yield so many incredibly rich findings about these experiences of love and courtship. I want to come back to this interdisciplinarity a little bit later on, but to begin, I thought we'd talk about the language of romantic love being mobilized through the 18th century. What were some of the influences shaping romantic scripts or stories about love in this moment? And how are these subsequently disseminated in the form of love letters?
So the first chapter of the book argues that courting couples followed a distinct kind of script for love. And so that is how kind of men and women knew that they were definitely engaging in courtship as lovers rather than just as friends. And so sometimes you can even see the moment, you know, in a man's letter that he takes it up a gear, you know, from writing as a friend to writing as a lover. And so by using this kind of shared language or script for negotiating love, couples could make sure that they were definitely, you know, on the same page, so to speak, because they were both using the same script. And so in the chapter, I divide the language of love into three constituent parts, looking at religious love, physical love, and literary love. And so, for example, talking about religious love, I found that the Bible was extremely important in shaping individual conceptions of love. And so many, especially devout couples, would kind of obliquely lift these prayers and thanksgivings from the Bible and from the Common Prayer Book and quote them in their love letters without necessarily saying they were doing so. While others equally would use their letters to debate theological ideas like, you know, were humans naturally virtuous or were humans naturally sinful? And that provided a really important way for more devout couples to kind of gauge their compatibility before marriage, to kind of weigh up their arguments against one another, to see how they got on and to see how their values aligned. And then equally in that chapter, I look at how different religious denominations shaped their relationships in different ways using these different languages of religious love. So, for example, I found that Quaker couples conceptualize marriage and love in a very different way in terms of they describe marriage as a union of spirits or a union of minds. And so it was very much kind of more kind of about the soul, and it didn't have this same emphasis on the body that you very often had in couples from other religious backgrounds. And so secondly, the chapter looks at physical symptoms of love. And so it was equally important to kind of set out the various physical symptoms you were experiencing in writing. So it wasn't enough to simply experience these things. You had to get them down on the page as kind of written evidence of the strength of your attachment in order to kind of help push your relationship forwards. And so couples described physical symptoms of love in their letters, like blushing, sighing, trembling, crying, fainting, sleeplessness, dreaming of a loved one, which all provided a way for them to kind of conceptualize and convey their devotion. And so the kind of discourses that couples were drawing upon also then changed over the century. So you've got the growing prominence of the nerves, for example, and nervous maladies and the experience of love with the growth of the culture of sensibility. And you also have new discourses entering this language. For example, people increasingly talked over the 18th century about the electricity between them and somebody else, or the chemistry that was bringing them together. So you can see how the language of love is very much socially and culturally and historically contingent, It's not a timeless language that can be employed by anyone at any moment in the same way. And then finally, the chapter explores how couples invoked particular literary figures as a way to chart the changing status of their relationship. And so the kinds of couples that suitors were talking about in the 18th century are people like Adam and Eve, Romeo and Juliet, Troilus and Cressida, Abelard and Heloise. And so these provided a kind of an important shared reference point for people to kind of pin their experiences on. And so writers often quoted entire passages from books without explicitly naming the source that they were quoted from. So they were kind of secure in the knowledge that the recipient would share that knowledge with them. They would know kind of which book they were quoting and understand its meaning. And so what I argue is that the reason this script was so important was because it helped couples to elucidate their feelings. It helped them to chart how their relationship was going. And it really helped them to build that closer emotional bond in pursuit of matrimony. And then in the following chapter on love letters, I then continue this theme of looking at love in words to consider how men and women use their letters in particular gendered ways in order to move a relationship forwards. So, for example, men were kind of constructed in wider culture as they were kind of the people in pursuit of courtship. So courtship was constructed as a kind of a sport or a hunt. And so because of that, men would always emphasize their sincerity and their honesty and their openness in love letters to kind of reassure the women that they were writing to that they had honorable intentions. Whereas women's letters were generally much more reserved and guarded about their emotions, you know, emphasizing their modesty and their desire to improve before marriage. But I mean, that doesn't mean just because women were more reserved, it doesn't mean they didn't have any power in the process. So, for example, women used the tools they had at their disposal as a source of leverage. So I looked at one woman, for example, called Charlotte Mary Kirwan, who was a Baptist minister's daughter. And she said that if this guy she was courting, Francis Cobb, if he didn't let her educate his children in the way that she saw fit, according to her religious views, she couldn't see their courtship progressing any further. So, I mean, couples use their letters in these particular gendered ways in order to progress a courtship in the direction that they wanted.
The book then moves on from written forms to address the relationship between expressions and love and material objects, and specifically tokens exchanged from around 1714 to 1830. Can you tell us a little bit more about these items, the ways that recipients interacted with them, and the different functions that they served?
Certainly. So, I mean, the kinds of objects I'm studying are items like gloves, garters, rings, locks of hair, portrait miniatures, bunches of flowers. So, I mean, broadly speaking, they're kind of small items that you could carry around. You could take them around with you in your pockets. You could put them under your pillow while you're asleep at night. You could hold them in the palm of your hand. And so within these objects, there was kind of a hierarchy of gifts in terms of which were the most socially and emotionally significant. So you had objects like flowers at the bottom because they were quite inexpensive. So you could pick flowers for free. And also friends, you know, commonly exchange flowers as a gift. Whereas at the very top of the hierarchy of gifts were these important objects like locks of hair and a ring that signified that you would soon be married. And they're the items, the most important ones, that if you then broke up, you were expected to give them back in order to formally terminate your relationship. And so the chapter brings together gifts that were typically given by women. So things like pressed flowers. Women commonly gave flowers like violets that were sent in their letters because they were a sign of kind of true and virtuous and faithful love. And it brings these together with objects that were very commonly selected by men. So things like stay busks and garters and rings, for example. And it looks at objects like letters and miniature portraits that were given by both sexes. So, I mean, when I was initially writing my thesis, I organized them according to types of object in terms of textiles and items relating to the body and so on. But I soon realized that actually what I think is really important here is what people were doing with these objects. So how they were using these material items to navigate and negotiate their love and their relationships in practice. And so the book structures the chapter on love tokens around these key rituals of gazing at, touching, kissing, caressing, and smelling love tokens. Because I think these were absolutely fundamental in eliciting and intensifying feelings of love. So for example, you know, writers very, very commonly described touching a lock of hair kind of for inspiration while composing their letters or composing poems while they were gazing at a portrait miniature. And so some of these items did have a historic association with courtship. So something like a glove, you know, had a very long association as a kind of love gift, whereas others, things like buttons, didn't necessarily. But they were still very commonly given as romantic gifts, because the key thing, I think, is what you did with these objects, kind of using the body, using the senses, what you did with them in order to move a relationship forward.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think the way that you've organized that chapter, as you described, around the experiences with the objects really brings that to the fore. I think that makes it really vivifies it for the reader. And your book explores not only the emotional and material experiences of courtship, but also the emergence of what you term a new marketplace of love. Can you describe some of the consumer developments that came out of this commodification of romantic love in this time? And what kind of effects did this have on existing customs?
Sure. So over the course of the Georgian era, I think there was an enormous kind of growing number and variety and range of consumer goods that could be exchanged by lovers. And so there's these items like snuff boxes, like perfume bottles, like printed watch papers, like seals, things like books. So couples very often sent their favorite books with kind of key passages underlined, saying things like, this is my favorite bit, or this is the bit I most agree with. I hope that you therefore agree with me. They often sent things like printed cottons that were kind of luxury, kind of exotic gifts, things like muslins as well, and furs. And again, so some of these, like watch papers, were very cheap. You could potentially cut it out of a magazine, but others, like furs, were extremely expensive. So again, there was a hierarchy in terms of which gifts were the most important, the most significant. And so this kind of growing range of gifts, it came printed very often with kind of romantic motifs. So things like snuff boxes, perfume bottles, watch papers, they came with a kind of stock selection of images on them, which again is how you knew they were definitely intended as romantic gifts. And things like seals as well. So people used specific seals given as love tokens in order to seal their love letters, and they'd say things in their letters like, look at my seal, you know, what do you think of it? And it would say something like, I love you on the seal. So, I mean, they're sending these messages almost through objects, which is especially important for women because it wasn't so common for them to be able to come out come out and say exactly how they felt in great detail in writing on paper in the same way that men did. And so, yeah, like I said, a lot of these objects were printed with these romantic motifs. So it's things like cupids, cherubs, hearts, lovebirds, burning torches, churches, couples looking out together towards a church, you know, under a title such as matrimony, which is quite an obvious hint if you get that as a gift, and kind of lovers in these kind of idyllic country settings. And so also these kind of gifts were very often imprinted with romantic declarations in French, which had kind of an international reputation as the language of courtship and flirtation and love and romance. So, I mean, couples were still exchanging older gifts such as rings that I look at in chapter three. They were still exchanging rings and garters and gloves, but they were doing so as part of a much more diverse range of objects. So what I believe the overarching shift is towards more goods and more choice for lovers as consumers. And so overall, what I believe we're seeing is the emergence of a love industry. And so this is kind of a new opportunity for the production, marketing, and consumption of love. And so you perhaps won't be surprised, therefore, to hear that at the same time, you've got the emergence of Valentine's Day as an explicitly commercial celebration. And so Valentine's Day had been celebrated in the 17th century, for example, but it was more generally through kind of communal collective rituals, such as engaging in lotteries when you pick someone's name out of a hat and give them a gift. Whereas by the 18th century, there's really important transformation in the celebration into more of the commercial event that we understand it as today. For example, you've got the rise of the Valentine card as a new consumer object. And I think that came out of the emergence of printed writing papers and cards that were being sold by booksellers and by stationers' shops, and the increasing range of kind of marbled, coloured and gilded papers that were available. So one of the people I studied in my book, he wrote to his daughter from France. You know, that in France, you could buy, people were writing in inks of every color on paper of every color. So there's this massive diversification of the kind of paper products available. And so the rise of the printed Valentine is very much bound up with this. And so the first surviving printed Valentine card that we know of was produced by the bookseller John Fairbairn, who had a shop on Minories in London. In 1797. So it's possible that there was one printed earlier, but this is the first one that has a date printed on the front, so we can date it with absolute certainty to the end of the 18th century. And so Valentine's Day has not been subject to very much scholarship at all in terms of histories of 18th century love and courtship. So one of the things I'm trying to do in my book is to kind of reinstate it as an 18th century celebration. I think the Georgian era is the absolute pivotal period in the invention of Valentine's Day as a modern celebration. And so in the last decade of the 18th century, you know, consumers could go into booksellers, into stationers, into printer shops, and they could choose between printed Valentine cards that had different images in the center, that had different decorative touches to make them kind of attractive consumer objects. And they'd have, for example, embossed borders around the outside that had cupids and declarations of love in French around the borders. And cobwebs, which is kind of a dome that was cut out of the paper in a circle, and you could lift up the dome using a string in the center in order to reveal a hidden picture inside. So there's all kind of new ways in which love was being marketed to consumers, kind of as a new commercial product. But, I mean, this is not to say this is a simple story of change, because the commercialization of romantic customs then also led to a reinvigoration of older traditions. As a response to the commercialization of love, the emergence of this new marketplace, there was also a reinvigoration of traditions dating back to the beginning of the 18th century. So couples then started sending each other hand-drawn cards that they'd made themselves, you know, watercolor cards that they cut out, acrostics based on a person's name, and kind of poems using the language of courtly love. So they were reinvigorating these deliberately archaic traditions and using this self-consciously archaic language. So they were using the language of courtly love in these handmade Valentine cards, which was kind of quaint by the end of the 18th century, because it had since been very much overtaken by the language of sensibility. And so I decided to split the material culture chapters into these two separate sections, one on sensory interaction with tokens in order to kind of show how people were moving a relationship forward by how they use their objects, but also a chapter on the marketplace of love in order to kind of pinpoint what was special about the 18th century, what was distinct about it, you know, what distinguished the 18th century marketplace of love from what came before in the 17th century. And so hopefully that helps to define the 18th century or the long 18th century as kind of a key era, a kind of a key period of change in which romantic customs very much evolved into more of a modern form in many ways.
Well, after attention to romantic love, you then close out the book in a really fascinating way by subverting readers' expectations of marriage and lifelong happiness to focus instead on romantic breakdowns. You do so through an exploration of language and experience and objects in a concluding chapter, Breach of Promise Cases. So what were some of the ways that people understood romantic hurt and failed courtships through the long 18th century?
So in the book, I argue that there was a really significant emotional shift that was connected to the cult of sensibility, where suffering from love was redefined as a uniquely female malady from the mid-18th century. So previously, kind of suffering because of your passion was associated with the language of courtly love, with troubadours, kind of sighing and groaning and dying from, you know, the pain of their love. But with the rise of the culture of sensibility, I think you have the redefinition of suffering from love as something that was kind of a uniquely female thing to experience. And so women were seen to suffer much more than men when their courtships came to an end because of their physical frailty, because of their weakened nerves, and because of their tender and feeling hearts. And so in kind of absolute worst case scenario, you know, a woman's romantic disappointment, it could lead to medical conditions like hysteria and kind of slowly wasting away until death. And so this wasn't just a kind of construction in wider culture. And so people also applied it to their relationships every day. And so I found quite a few examples of women who would write to their friends if they'd recently been through a breakup and try to kind of talk them through it, saying, you know, don't sink under your passion, you know, like a common weak-minded woman. You know, you've got to rouse yourself. You've got to try and overcome this because, you know, the expectation was that romantic disappointment was almost impossible for a woman to overcome. I mean, some of the women I've studied in their letters, they described it as being like a worm that gnawed upon your very vitals. It was something that kind of gnawed away or wore you away until the grave. And so in contrast, because of this important kind of cultural and emotional shift, men were kind of widely seen as being able to stifle love much more easily than women could. And so men were urged in wider culture not to dwell, not to whine about, not to kind of fixate too much upon romantic disappointment, because it would show their kind of lack of manliness, their idleness, and their lack of self-control. And so conduct books talked a lot about this in terms of warning men not to get fixated upon romantic disappointment in the same way that a woman would. And it urged them to fly to, you know, employment, because, you know, a man who was suffering too much from romantic disappointment, he obviously just didn't have enough to occupy himself, whereas he should have. And so in a related shift, The period also saw the redefinition of suicide as a masculine act of heroism, gallantry, courage, and passion. And so the ultimate heroic suicide in popular culture was the suicide of Goethe's Werther. So the hero of the epistolary novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, at the end of the novel, he shot himself with two pistols because of his disappointment in love. And so that then inspired a wave of copycat suicides right across Europe. So it was a new kind of new cultural trope, a new way of understanding romantic disappointment, both for men and for women. And you can see the key dichotomy here, which is that while the women were kind of seen to waste away, to droop, to wilt and die, you know, they didn't really have any choice over the matter. Whereas men made this kind of gallant and heroic and courageous decision to end their lives. So these are the kind of the new gender dichotomies in terms of how heartbreak was understood and presented culturally. And then I then explore this more in the final chapter on breach of promise. So I find that this emotional shift concerning who could legitimately suffer when a relationship came to an end first became reflected in a legal context in breach of promise cases in the 1790s. And so that, again, saw an important change in kind of how breach of promise actions worked. So because of this new emotional regime, because of this emotional shift, there was a completely new understanding of romantic suffering, both culturally and under the law. And through both of these chapters, again, I've woven objects such as love letters and love tokens. So I found that as a relationship was coming to a conclusion, if a man or a woman wanted to be completely sure that the person they were courting knew a relationship was definitely over, you had to return the letters that you'd exchanged, and you had to return tokens such as rings and locks of hair. Otherwise, I found some men, discussing with their friends, saying, "Well, you know, if she's not giving me my letters back, how, you know, maybe we are still courting. You know, how do I know that it's definitely over?" So you had to give back these objects in order to formally terminate your relationship. And equally, if you didn't, you could then produce them as evidence in court. So I found that love letters were routinely produced as evidence of a serious romantic relationship in the common law courts in breach of promise cases. So you can see that the love letter is significant in terms of how people kind of conceptualize and convey and express their emotions. It's significant in terms of how people navigate their relationships by kind of through the senses, by, you know, sleeping with love letters kind of beneath their pillows at night. But they're also significant in a legal sense, because if you held on to your love letters, you could then use it as evidence of a serious relationship. And it was very common for these love letters to be read out in their entirety in court and to judge the quality of the language that was used in them. And sometimes if a letter wasn't suitably effusive or wasn't drawing upon this script for love that I talked about in chapter one of the book, it wouldn't be admitted as evidence of love. So again, it's these important kind of tropes shaping how people understood and conducted their relationships. They were important right the way through a relationship from the beginning when you were first forming it. Right until the end, in order to enable you, especially as a woman, to prove that a relationship happened. So, you know, women held on to their love letters because they might need to call on them as evidence later on.
Throughout the book, you mobilize a range of approaches to explore the history of romantic love in this moment. This includes work in material history, as you've discussed, but also other disciplines beyond history, from anthropology to psychology. So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to these interdisciplinary methodologies and how they shaped your project?
Certainly. So, I mean, the two areas that I draw upon most heavily, material culture history and emotions history, are both fundamentally interdisciplinary. So, I mean, you know, in many ways, it makes, you know, it's completely, it makes complete and absolute sense that my book would therefore be interdisciplinary as well. So, I mean, in interpreting objects, for example, I've drawn a lot on anthropological work by people looking at gift exchange, like Marcel Mauss, his work The Gift, like Annette B. Wiener and her work on inalienable possessions, and by anthropologists like Daniel Miller in works like The Comfort of Things, as well as work by art historians like Jules David Proud and his book Art as Evidence, in terms of how, what kind of method we use to interpret objects and their meaning and what we can kind of draw from this in constructing our histories. And then equally, I've drawn a lot on work in the history of emotions, which comes from a real range of fields, like you said, you know, including, you know, philosophy, psychology, sociology, literary studies. So I suppose some of the most important for me have been people like the ethnographer Monique Scheer. And so she wrote this incredible article on emotion as a kind of practice. And I suppose that has been one of the most influential, if not the most influential, kind of approach for my book, in terms of approaching love as something that we do. You know, love is a verb, following Scheer's theory. It's something that we do in practice through particular languages, by writing letters, by exchanging gifts, by using these particular kind of embodied rituals. And therefore, it's something that's very much historically specific. And so therefore, it's something that we can study. And equally, I was quite influenced by the psychologist and neuroscientist Lisa Feldman-Barrett's work on emotions in the brain, in terms of thinking about how objects inspire these emotional responses and the people that interact with them and the people that use them. Particularly in terms of thinking about affect and emotion and the brain. And so I hope that by drawing upon these various theories, you know, in anthropology, in art history, you know, ethnography, you know, in psychology, I hope I've been able to bring together quite a diverse range of textual, of visual, and of material sources in order to construct my arguments. So they're both textual on one level, because I'm looking at people describing the gifts that they gave in letters. They're also material in terms of, you know, using these non-textual sources to provide kind of a different view, a different perspective on love and the materiality of love. And visual sources as well, obviously, such as prints and paintings. And so what I hope is that overall, by drawing upon this breadth of kind of sources from across different disciplines and the breadth of historiography, breadth of research across disciplines, I hope that I've managed to create a much more holistic history. So it analyzes love in text, in objects, through the body, through gestures, through the senses. And so what I'm trying to do is really to respond to Monique Scheer's call for historians of the emotions to think harder about what people are doing by looking at the bodies and artifacts of the past. And so love emerges from that as something that we do. And in the 18th century, it was something that people did through exchanging letters and tokens, through interacting with them, you know, through the body, through the senses, and using these particular scripts and rituals that were shared among all people who were engaging in courtship at the time.
Well, I think you've certainly succeeded on that front. As a reader, I can say expressions of love move off of the written page in the book itself, and you can really understand the feelings and experiences of many of your subjects. So congratulations on such a fantastic book. So we are almost out of time, though, so I want to thank you for joining us. And before we go, here at the New Books Network, we traditionally end our discussions by asking, what are you working on next?
So next, my next big project is examining the history of heartbreak in Britain over the long durée. So thinking about what happened when the heart literally ruptured as a consequence of love. And also cultural constructions of broken hearts, of jilting, of disappointed and unrequited love. And so you can see it's in some ways it's grown out of chapter 5 of my book on romantic suffering, but it extends it to also incorporate medicine and embodiment, and also over a much longer time period. So stretching right from the late 17th to the early 20th century. And so in some ways, it's a sequel to The Game of Love in Georgian England. It's looking at kind of the price of love or the cost of love over the long durée.
That sounds excellent. We look forward to it. Thanks again to you, Sally. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
And thanks, of course, to all of our listeners. Until next time.